the continuation of this meeting that we began on August 20th. As I speak, if I'm forgetting people in the chat rooms and they text you, just wave at me or let me know that they're waiting. But I'm prepared. Everybody who I asked to come is here. So without no further ado, let's begin. Ted, are you on, Ted?
I'm on.
Okay. Martha, I see Martha. Judge Town.
Yo.
And Judge Ibarra. Okay.
I'm on.
Commissioner. And Lisa, are you here, Lisa?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
And Mark, I would like to make a motion for an amendment to the agenda.
Second.
And the motion that I
trust you,
I'm
Martha.
I'm going to move that when we start discussing specific places and facilities that we go into executive session, because we could be revealing some security issues that should not be public. And, you know, this is for our discussion. We also did this with the CPMC when we were doing our capacity analysis in 2001. As we progress, we will be discussing more in public, but this is our very first discussion on this. So that's my motion to go into executive session.
Can we defer that until it comes up, Martha, or do we have to anticipate that?
Excuse me?
Can we defer that motion until we hear specifics, rather than an open-ended motion?
No, I'm asking that today we amend the agenda. At the end of the agenda, we go into executive session.
And this is to discuss the emergency capacity?
Yes.
Okay.
And again, this is just the first cut. Our first cut.
Ted, so you agree with that second?
Yeah, I'm seconding. Okay. I second Martha's motion.
Just so everybody's on the same page, we're going to have the discussion on the COVID-19 situation in OCCC and the rest of our public safety. And then after that, we're going to have the public testimony and then excuse for an executive session.
I think you need to have a vote on it.
Yeah, that's so we understand what the process is. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Go ahead, Judge Ibarra, you have something to say?
I have a question for Lisa. So this comes out of one of the exceptions.
What are you talking about? Are we
allowed to go into executive sessions, just to be clear?
Yes, assuming everyone votes and agrees, the majority agrees to go into executive session.
Okay.
I'm talking about the subject matter.
You mean to amend the meeting agenda?
No, subject matter of discussing capacities, the emergency capacities.
Yes.
And I really want to talk about elements we should consider in that discussion.
Yes.
In executive session.
In executive session, yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
All in favor, say aye.
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 I pass. Also,
say same. Oh, thank you. Motion pass. Okay, once again, I wanted to greet everybody. Some of you may have to mute your mic so that we can have hear clearly. Thank you. Since the last meeting, I was able to get in contact with both PSD, who is present, but also the Department of Health. Now, we wanted to have these hearings really to concern ourselves with the current crisis within OCCC and how the rest of the system is being prepared for it, so that the crisis doesn't happen in the other jails as well. So if you remember, the deputy director of PSD, Ms. Kimono, talked about they're taking a lot of lead from the Department of Health in terms of battling the virus situation. So I invited the deputy director of, I invited Department of Health to come, and Deputy Director Marcel is here to talk to us. Really interesting about how you folks are responded to the virus situation within the prison system. What is the relief situation going on and what do we look for down the road as far as recovery? So, Eddie, if you don't mind me calling you Eddie, you want to go ahead?
Thank you, Mark. And please call me Eddie. It's much easier to say that than my last name. So, I asked Dr. Curtis and Dr. Kemble to join us as well. They've been much more intimately involved in partnering with public safety to address the outbreak in OCCC. So I'll ask them to talk a little bit about some of the steps that have been taken, including testing and tracing and stuff like that. I will talk a little bit about what we're doing kind of on the outside, as folks do get released per the Supreme Court order and as they get released in terms of other reasons and stuff like that. Primarily, one of the that we continue to have is that of capacity, and it's the same issue that we've had pre-COVID in terms of capacity and early on in this pandemic when inmates were released to decompress the prisons. And so some of the things that we're doing are working very, very hard to develop that capacity as quickly as we possibly can, while at the same time being mindful of both the individual safety and systemic safety of all of the folks concerned. One of the things that we've done in the Behavioral Health Administration recently kind of took over management overall for the county, primarily on Oahu, of all of the quarantine and isolation managed units for the Department of Health. Originally, we were just doing primarily behavioral health and homelessness, with, as many of you have probably seen in the news and in the media, the Ka'ahi Street facility, which was primarily for behavioral health homelessness individuals. What we've done in the last, probably since the 12th, I think, is when we started to kind of actively and officially manage the other hotel isolation units, is we've increased those units in the last 2 weeks by 60. So we've added about 60 new units to quarantine and isolation. We're pulling in more resources to provide wrap services, case management, some low-level medical support and check-ins, that kind of thing. And we're really working with public safety to try to identify who is coming out and whether or not they can safely isolate or quarantine in their own home or in some other situation beyond what they currently have. And so as some of you probably are aware, that's a difficult thing to coordinate, because oftentimes we don't know when people are being released until that very same day. And one of the things that from the behavioral health standpoint we want to take into consideration is whether or not there's any kind of other underlying issues like mental health, substance abuse, those kinds of, you know, potential violence or domestic violence issues. And so we do need to have some semblance of kind of assessment and evaluation so that appropriately place folks in quarantine and isolation if they need it. So I think Dr. Curtis and Dr. Kemble are working with, they're meeting with public safety on a day-to-day basis. It's not going to be perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but we're going to continue to work with and partner with public safety and support them in any way we can. We also do need to keep, to kind of keep our own staff and our own providers safe as well. So those are all considerations that we have. So I'll kind of turn it over to Dr. Kemble and Dr. Curtis to talk a little bit about, from the standpoint of within the facility, the steps that have been taken. And I'm sure Deputy Director Kimoto is on as well. So we'll defer to her as well for any of that part of the discussion.
Hi, Hi, thanks, Eddie. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, great. I can start off, and I'm sure Dr. Curtis may have some additional comments from her perspective. I've been representing Doc D and providing technical assistance to OCCC in regards to response to the outbreak and cohorting of ill and not ill, positive and not positive inmates and staff, exclusions, et cetera. So as Eddie said, we've been having daily meetings with OCCC facility management and healthcare to discuss both newly arisen cases and next steps to be taken and testing strategies. Just to provide a brief overall EPI summary on the situation, we, as of today, I just closed the document that has the numbers in front of me. So I'll try to reopen, but we have, I believe we stand at 284 confirmed cases within OCCC related to this outbreak, of which there are 44 staff at my last count, and the remainder are inmate cases. Those are preliminary numbers, so they are going to be subject to change as the investigation continues. And sometimes we do have a reclassification or we discover a duplication error, so there may be a couple counts that come off. But I think that's about where we've leveled out right now. We've done a complete testing sweep of the entire facility over the last week and a half, starting with the facility, with the module, housing unit modules that we knew were most heavily impacted because of the initial cases that were reported. And we do have four of the more chronic housing open barracks units that are at least 30% infected and perhaps much higher than that, where cohorting was really a challenge and so not really feasible in the proper sense of the word. And I can talk more about that later. We also have the intake module, which is fairly heavily affected, which is where we believe the outbreak may have originated. But it also appears that there may be multiple introductions from the community at play here. So we have not ruled out that this is sort of a new state where we're going to continue to see introductions from the community in correctional settings. We have determined that there are a number of modules, and I don't have exact counts in front of me today because some of them are not housing units, but we've looked at modules 1 up to 20 that are outside of the open barrack situations. And most of those modules that are not open barracks are less affected, and some are don't appear to be affected at all at this point in time. That being said, we're being quite cautious because we do know that some staff have floated during the outbreak period, and we want to be sure that we're not missing people who may be incubating and could still become positive and cause further transmission. So in those units where it's possible to remove the positives as we discover them, we've been attempting to do so. And we have recommended that inmates who are more severely symptomatic be removed to medical isolation to the extent possible so they can have closer observation. To date, we've had one hospitalization related to the outbreak. And that is actually, I think, surprising to us in a way for the large number of positive inmates. With over 240 positive inmates, that we would see not so many hospitalizations after 10 days into this outbreak. I think the jury's still out on that. I mean, we have not seen the end of this yet, but we are encouraged that there has not been a very severe burden of disease up to this point. In terms of transfers, we have currently asked the facility to lock down all transfers between housing modules, except for specific discussions we've had about when an inmate needs to be moved because of space issues. And we make joint decisions together with the facility staff about which movements could be considered as appropriate within infection control guidance based on what we know about the positive rates in those modules. Also, interfacility transfers are on lockdown as well. There are a few that have had to occur or may have occurred before the outbreak was fully recognized. We did have one positive at a second correctional facility who luckily was already in quarantine and remains in isolation now with that positive result. But our concern, of course, immediately was that this could rapidly extend to multiple correctional facilities if we didn't get a handle on this quickly. So the other thing we've been discussing actively is releases of inmates who are finished with their term of incarceration or who are released because of court rulings or actions. And this has been a very challenging area because there's very little notice before those people are released. And we've had, you know, every situation arise. Sometimes we may know the person is positive. Sometimes we may know they have tested negative at least once. But knowing that a negative test is just a point in time, so it doesn't tell us whether they will remain negative for the duration of their incubation period. And we've also had people who've yet to be tested who were released. Some of these inmates have been successfully placed if they didn't have an appropriate place to go for isolation and quarantine. But sometimes with the last minute notice, it is not always feasible for us to find placement via the current Department of Health procedures or to even be able to contact that person after they've left. We have worked with corrections to obtain the best contact information we can, but in some situations, the information given is not an actual working contact number, or we may not be able to reach them despite having some limited information about their whereabouts. So that's an ongoing concern that has been raised a number of challenges. So I'll stop there. Amy, do you have anything you want to add at this point?
You know, as you know, Sarah, I've mostly helped looking now at the ISO and quarantine side, although we have seen a little bit of, you know, some of the outbreaks that we're looking at in treatment facilities that may have some relationship to OCCC as well. However, for the isolation and quarantine, I would say just reiterate what Eddie said, having that some way of information of contact and being able to set up the isolation and quarantine before they leave is what we're really trying to work on, because I think that's going to be important to do, and how we have that connection in place as closely as possible. We have been giving the CARES line now to the individuals that are leaving, and we are receiving calls both from individuals and I think also from maybe parole officers as well, or several other interested family members. So we've been able to link some individuals into isolation and quarantine that way.
So Mark, we'll leave it there and see if there are any questions or other follow-up pieces of information that we can provide from the DOH perspective.
Commissioners, any questions at this time?
Mark?
Yes.
It's Ted.
Go ahead, Ted.
I have a few. Eddie, it's Ted Sakai. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Ted.
Just a general question, if you know, one of the concerns, back up a bit, this is actually a continuation of a meeting that we had last week, and the commission felt that it was important to get more detailed information because of the seriousness of what's happening at OCCC. But one of the questions we had was the new inmates coming into OCCC. Do you folks have a sense of how many new inmates are coming into OCCC and the facility's ability to properly test and quarantine the new inmates coming in? Or is that a PSD question?
Yeah, Ted, I think that might be a PSD question. I think from what Dr. Kemble and Dr. Curtis are saying is that we're right there shoulder to shoulder with PSD to support them in any way we can. I think in terms of understanding what the numbers are, though, I think that I might have to defer to
sure.
Director Kimoto.
Okay. Another question I have is, are you folks looking at the assistance that PSD might have with some other facilities, particularly the neighbor island facilities, because the conditions are perhaps even worse? I mean, the physical design and limited bed space, all of that, lack of... but those conditions are going to be even more challenging. And I don't I haven't heard of any cases on the neighbor islands, but if anything gets in, it's going to be a tremendous challenge, I believe. So have you folks considered giving any assistance to PSD in that regard?
We will stand by to provide whatever assistance we possibly can to PSD. And I think one of the ways that we might be able to do that is to start to look at prevention protocols that we might be able to put into place that that look towards keeping the virus as much as possible out of the facility. As much as we possibly can. And there are some basic things that we can do, thermal testing, for example, some of those other kinds of things that we can potentially do. And then also DOH will work, my administration will work with the district health officers to determine if there are certain resources that we can leverage for maybe helping with alleviating some of the population stress. And that's a conversation that I've been having already with the DHOs in terms of trying to identify what level of and capacity of alternative quarantine and isolation sites that they have. Again, as we all know, the resources on the neighbor islands in many ways are more strained than they are on Oahu, but in some ways the neighbor islands are more effective at linking and sinking than we are on Oahu. So I think that it's just a matter of figuring out how we can work with them and support them.
Yeah, I was really heartened by your report about how you're locating spaces in the community. I think it was hotel rooms or something to that effect where quarantine can be affected. But just as a follow-up, and maybe this is a Dr. Curtis or Dr. Kemble question. I know the court had ordered releases of certain categories of inmates, but the way I read the court order, there's going to be a number of inmates who may not be charged with really serious offenses, but who will not qualify for release under the court order because of the particular type of crime that they were charged with. But they may be in for short sentences, and their sentences may be expiring in the next, I don't know, days or weeks. And I'm wondering how you folks are preparing for that.
Yeah, so the key question there from an infection control or mitigation standpoint for spread of COVID is really around how can we identify those who would have cleared their isolation. There are many who are positive who are already hitting their clearance dates for isolation, meaning they have been more than 10 days since their symptom onset or the date of their positive test, and they have not developed significant symptoms or their symptoms have resolved. So those people, based on CDC guidance, are no longer infectious to others, and there would be no reason to restrict their release.
Right.
So I think that's the group that we're really trying to figure out a system where they have something in hand when they leave that can indicate that they are cleared from that standpoint. And I think it's the challenge we're experiencing is how to have enough advance notice that someone, be it within the OCCC facility system or from Department of Health, can put a document in their hand of some kind to say, this defines my period of isolation, and hence I am now cleared from isolation.
Oh, yeah. I was referring to inmates who may not be released, but mm-hmm. whose term of incarceration might end, say, end of this week, and they haven't been cleared,
mm-hmm.
or they might.
So that's another group. And the challenge there and the concern would be where would they have a appropriate and safe place to complete isolation and quarantine after being released? That again has been a challenge for the same reasons. So if they aren't yet at that point where from a public health standpoint, they're no longer infectious or no longer at risk of becoming infectious,
mm-hmm.
then there's still the issue of, okay, they've served their term within the jail, but Where are they going to go and avoid causing new outbreaks? Because many people, as we're seeing, are going on to other congregate settings, be it a shelter, halfway house program, recovery program. And we have already seen some spillover into those settings because of people who left while incubating before the outbreak was, the scope of the outbreak was defined. And they have led to some additional transmission in other settings. So that is the key concern, is we want to avoid having this cause new pockets of transmission community-wide in these types of congregate settings. So that's been sort of the logic behind trying to figure out a system to either limit those releases as legally acceptable or find a way to slow down that process or have enough advance notice to make some preparations for those releases. Now, for somebody to leave, if they can go to a setting that can appropriately handle isolation and quarantine, that's fine. There's no reason from a infection standpoint that we wouldn't want that to happen. But I think a lot of the community settings still don't feel adequately prepared or equipped to handle isolation and quarantine.
Yeah, I would be concerned with people in OCCC who might be charged or sentenced for crimes related to domestic violence. And we may not want them to go back to their original settings. So just a thought for consideration.
I think I saw some questions in the chat too about what do I mean about inability to cohort. So this was new to me, dealing with this type of outbreak in a large correctional facility like this. But as we found the first modules that were heavily impacted, we were talking about how to try to separate positive from negative. Now, one of the first challenges is that being negative on the day we test doesn't mean you're going to be negative tomorrow or the next day or the day after. You may become positive. And when we see, as we saw in one housing unit, 70% positive rate, that means it's very likely the vast majority of the remaining inmates will go on to convert to positive, even though they tested negative on that date. Because at that point, the exposure has been so heavy that it's very likely they're exposed already. And no matter what you do to separate them now, they will still become positive. Even then, we would ideally want to separate them from the positives as long as we could and retest to see if they convert. But what we learned was that there are many gang affiliations, and we were told that people were at higher risk in some cases when they attempted to move them from assault from an opposing gang member if they moved them to a different area than from COVID itself. And so in light of that, plus the fact that some of those areas are sharing bathrooms, dining areas, things that they need access to, and they have to walk through the entire dorm to get there, it's just not an environment designed for the kind of cohorting that we're talking about. It's not like a long-term care facility where you can set up your separate COVID unit, have a zip wall that separates it. I mean, we're talking about these ideal world circumstances and then, you know, what the space constraints are.
Yeah, thank you for recognizing the challenge. I have one last area of questions. I don't want to dominate everything, but all the questioning. I'm sure the other commissioners have questions too. But regarding the correctional officers, have you folks, you mentioned 44 staff have been tested positive. And I'm assuming that most, if not all, are correctional officers because they make up the big majority of the staff there. What kind of contact?
It's been a blend of correctional officers. I would say they are the majority, but there are also food service staff, other support staff.
Oh.
So it's affected multiple roles.
Yeah, I guess in a closed setting, it's hard to avoid contact with your fellow workers.
Yeah. So, remember that many of the inmates assist with food service as well. So there is.
I'm sorry. You got muted there. I didn't hear what you said.
Oh, many of the inmates assist with food service as well, and that that housing unit was affected, so that resulted in some spillover.
I see. Okay, Mark, I'll turn it over to someone else.
Mark, Mike Town, I'm wondering if any staff have been hospitalized, and including the and inmates? What's the total hospitalization?
I have not been told of any staff being hospitalized at this point in time. So to my knowledge, there have been zero staff hospitalized up to today. The one inmate that we knew was hospitalized from OCCC remains in the hospital. But
you got to speak up.
One inmate that was transferred to the hospital from OCCC remains hospitalized today, but I'm told is in stable condition at this time. We wouldn't know if there are inmates who left the jail already and subsequently were hospitalized. We may not be aware of all of those people at this point in time. So I can't say with certainty there aren't others, but at this point, I'm only aware of the one who was transferred directly out from OCCC to a hospital.
And you would or you would not know if anybody's been had a ventilator installed?
There's been nobody requiring mechanical ventilation who was hospitalized in this outbreak so far.
All right. I hope that's the case. Thank you.
Ronald, Judge Ibarra, you have any questions?
You muted us all, Mark.
Okay. Hold on, everybody. Can't you unmute yourselves as well? No?
No.
Yeah, I could unmute myself, but Ron only has his phone that he's using.
Okay. I got it.
Okay, good.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, ahead, my Ron. Question is, either Dr. Curtis or Eddie, or my question is, someone said that the entire inmate population has been tested. Is that correct, as of a particular day?
We've done a sweep through the entire facility, so it's testing has been offered to every inmate. Not every inmate has accepted testing. So there are refusals, and so it's not a complete 100% survey.
So, but everyone was offered?
Everyone was offered testing.
As of what day?
As of the 20th.
Okay, and how long will the results take to get back?
Those results are all back in.
So one of the the biggest issues in the Supreme Court order is no positive test result in order for the pretrial release detainees. So my question is, so all the release, all the test results are in as of the 24th?
As of the 20th, all the initial test results from the first round of testing are back. But as I said, people who test negative on the first round but are exposed may still be at high risk of becoming positive in the subsequent days. So right now, testing is ongoing to repeat rounds of testing and throughout the jail again.
So until the second round of testing is complete and the results are in, no pretrial release?
I think there may be certain housing units where we could begin after the second round of testing, we could more safely say this unit appears to be unaffected. Now the refusals introduce some uncertainty, so we can't say with certainty that there isn't a missed case in there. But if we have two rounds of negative testing about a week apart in a particular housing unit, then we can feel more confident that that unit is likely not affected. And it would be reasonable then to say that unit could go on with releases as per usual, without additional restriction. For a unit that had a pretty large number of positives on the first round, and you continue to see positives on subsequent rounds, it's much harder to say that those people, if you release them, are not gonna pose an infectious risk. The other concern I have about those releases is what kind of medical oversight would they have? And what if they did develop more severe disease, if they're homeless, is that going to be picked up? Are they going to have access to medical services? So those are some of the concerns with the initial negatives who may still be exposed in some of the more heavily affected units.
Okay, I understand your concern. What mm-hmm. units have been cleared for release?
None as of today, because the second round of testing is not completed.
So you're saying that the first round of testing mm-hmm. indicates that an entire population again must be tested?
So for example, in other congregate settings like nursing homes, the recommendation has been to do weekly rounds of testing or approximately weekly rounds of testing until you have 2 weeks of all negative testing. And the reason for that is your incubation period is 14 days. So up until that 14th day, you may still have people exposed initially who will continue to convert.
And I understand, but didn't you say there's some units that may not be going into second test depending on the risk?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
Are there any units that will not go into a second testing?
There, I think likely we'll be doing repeat testing of all, at least offering repeat testing of all negatives. There are some units that are so heavily impacted that one could also make the argument to simply wait a certain period of time after which you could safely say infection has burned through that entire unit. So if test resources become an issue, they are sort of the lowest priority for repeat testing. But newly symptomatic inmates should always be prioritized. And then the units where we had mixed cohorts and there was a possibility to separate the ill from the well, that's where we really want to focus repeat testing first, because that's where we can salvage the most and try to prevent additional transmission of disease.
I hear you. My question is simple. Are there any units that need not go to a second test so that PSD can immediately comply with a court order and release?
No, not from that standpoint, because the first round of negative testing does not prove that they are untouched.
So the entire population has to go through second testing?
Well, I think what you're getting at, the units that appear negative on the first round definitely need to go through second testing. It's the units that are 71% positive that might not need to go through second testing. However, those ones obviously are more problematic to release.
Judge, if I could just add, Judge, very similar to what we did with IHS, the men's facility, we had of that whole entire population, we had some who had tested negative in the first round. We did a second round. Some of those that tested negative tested positive in the second round because of the, as Dr. Kemble was talking about, the risk of them having been infected or exposed by that interaction. Because it's a congregate environment, you can't really assume that the first round of testing is gonna be the determining factor of whether or not an individual is gonna be positive.
So yeah. I guess you keep testing until the positive test gets less and the risk factor is less, and then you can finally say certain units are cleared to be released.
Yeah, that's the general idea. I would set the expectation that this can take many weeks in this type of setting, and so it may be a long time. So I also think there may be other considerations of, you know, is there a way to find ways to release people to a safe setting so that they are not held unnecessarily long. You know, I see that side of it too. And so all I can speak to is, you know, my technical expertise is on what's the risk of infection. But you have to weigh that against the risk of infection out in the community too. You know, there's infection out in the community too. So it's not like they're the only ones posing an infectious risk to the general population. Anybody's neighbor could be posing an infectious risk to the general population. So yeah, there may be other solutions that have to be come to because of the length of time it may take to clear this outbreak in this facility.
Are you familiar with the Supreme Court order that says subject to the following conditions, you know, this is petty misdemeanors and misdemeanors, the inmate has not received a positive COVID-19 test result, is not pending the result of a test that has been taken, and is not exhibiting COVID-19 symptoms. So it doesn't say that, you know, you keep on testing until your risk reduction is less.
I think the question of when you decide to release someone is a little different. I mean, it's a different question than what's the ideal repeat testing strategy. So I can't answer that completely from a public health standpoint. I think that's more of a global decision-making problem that has to be tackled with this group, because I can speak to what's the infectious risk, but whether it's right to continue to hold somebody throughout the entire period is not something I can speak to directly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Ibarra. Martha, you have anything on your mind?
I'm just realizing what a huge problem this is for the Department of Health, because every day new people are coming in, and I presume now that OCCC is definitely trying to separate the new people from the people already in the facility. But as Dr. Kimball said, it may be their second test comes up positive because there was exposure. Dr. Kimball, is there any attempt, and I know you have limited on how many people you can test, but is there any attempt to test people who have planned releases, like 2 days before they're going to be released, to make sure they are still COVID-free?
The weekly testing should help to address that, because they should have all had testing at least within the last week. I don't know that we can hit a target like 2 days exactly before release, but we do have the list of scheduled releases, and we are reviewing those to make sure those people's status has been addressed before their scheduled release date. That's actually the small list, though, and that's what we're realizing. There are 5, 10, 20 releases a day sometimes that are unscheduled, and those, we don't have enough advance notice to make sure that they were prioritized for testing before their release. At least now we have a first round done, so we have some sense of status, and we also, if we know what module they're coming out of, and they haven't been transferring modules, we can at least speak to what's the risk for that particular module. But this gets into some nuanced decision making, and it's going to be an involved process.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question I really wanna, trying to figure out how to frame it. It was reported by PSD in our original meeting that many of the positives were asymptomatic, okay? Mm-hmm. So we looked at the numbers climbing in the first few days, maybe a week and a half ago, and many of them were being said were asymptomatic. And now maybe, I'm not sure the exact date when it started, but I'm pretty sure we're more than 10 days since that day. So is there a particular day where now we're looking at those original numbers and saying they are no longer being counted because they didn't develop any symptoms? So are they being taken off the positive list? Does that make sense to you, Eddie?
So in terms of the total outbreak numbers and how we reflect those, we always reflect those in cumulative counts. So people, of course, end up being cleared at some point, and then they're no longer infectious, but they're still counted as a case towards the outbreak. So we're not subtracting positives from the total counts, but your question does get at an important point, which is that at some point people do clear. So it's also important to track that clearance and know which groups of people no longer pose an infectious risk. In some ways, the post-infectious inmate is the easiest to decide how to manage, because you now, after 10 days, assuming they didn't have severe disease or other special factors that would prolong their isolation period, then those people are no longer posing an infectious risk to the public, and they aren't at risk of reinfection immediately. And so those people can actually be cohorted with anyone. They can be released if their legal release time has come due. And those people are easy to deal with. It's really the exposed and incubating group that is more challenging.
We could probably get more numbers when we have when we talk to PSD in a little bit, but that's mm-hmm. exactly what I wanted to hear, Sarah. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm.
Mark, I have another question.
Go ahead, Ted.
Yeah, Eddie, Dr. Kimball talked about access to medical care might be an issue for some of the people being released into the community. Is Eddie still there?
Still here, Ted.
Oh, okay. Yeah, is health insurance an issue for this particular group, people coming out of jail?
I think in general, I think it would be safe to say that health insurance is an issue. Oftentimes, when somebody's getting newly released, they have to get restarted on Medicaid. or DHS-supported insurances. So in general, I would guess that most folks that are being released are not necessarily covered by any medical insurance.
So this might be something that PSD would have to work out with DHS to try to arrange for the coverage to start as soon as possible after release.
Yeah, I believe that there's already systems in place that whereby PSD works as much as possible, works with the individual as well as DHS to get people insured. But again, like Sarah talked about, unscheduled releases are always the issue, right? Where we don't have that lead time to plan for that reentry process to address all of those needs that an individual might have as they're kind of leaving the facility and coming right back into the community. So in those cases, what generally happens, if they're not going back to family households or they're not, if they don't have some place to isolate or quarantine or just be able to go and stay, they're coming into our shelters or coming into our community programs, who then at that point will pick up that burden to try to help them get the services and coverage that they need.
Hey, thank you.
If none of the commissioners have any more questions, go to Eddie and his group. Eddie, can you just stand by as we ask Ms. Kimoto to kind of brief us on, from her point of view, what's going on right now?
Sure, Mark. I'll ask Dr. Kemble and Dr. Curtis to stand. I have a 4 o'clock meeting with some Pacific Islander community leaders, so I'll jump off in a little bit to go to that. But I leave you in capable hands.
Okay, thank you so much, Eddie. I appreciate it. Sherry, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Sherry, having heard what the Department of Human, Department of Health has just presented to us, fellow commissioners, I just, you know, you still have some questions you want to present to Sherry at this time. I'm open for inquiries. Anybody? Mike? I'm muted. Jerry, were you listening to Judge Ibarra's questioning on the releases?
Yes, I was.
Okay. So because Sarah talked about the second round of testing, that necessarily is not going to stop somebody being released if he's already gone through the first one and was negative, right?
Correct. And just to clarify, under the Hawaii Supreme Court order, we have released inmates that did not fall into that category of being positive or pending a test. So our team has been going through every single name, every single list, double checking, triple checking, and then if cleared, released.
So in terms of the asymptomatic positives, or any positive for that matter, if they qualify for the release, it's just a matter is it being managed that this date, if they're still no longer positive or they're coming off that quarantine period, okay, that's when they'll be released?
So as of today, our first housing unit is coming off the quarantine. The positives are coming off the quarantine. So what we're doing is going through all of our quote-unquote holds from possible release, because either they were positive and they were still within their quarantine or they were pending a test. And every day what we do is we just go through that one list again and we try to clear everybody who is no longer pending a test, negative, or once they will clear quarantine and we're clear with Dr. Kemble and we're clear with Dr. Mee, then we'll process release. So it's not just incoming orders that we are reviewing, it's also re-reviewing the orders in which we had to hold them from being released.
Do you have any numbers of what you've released since this the crisis started?
We will have to get back to you on that.
Okay.
And Shari, I think in getting back with those numbers, you need to be able to bifurcate between those released because of the court order versus those that were planned releases because they completed their sentence or they were bailed out.
Okay, will do.
Thank you.
When listening to Ms. Kimball and Ms. Curtis's report on the trying to understand the testing process, the asymptomatic, the symptomatic, knowing that you know you have an influx of offenders coming in on a daily basis, you know you have like a miniature culture right now that a virus is operating within. How do you see yourself, you know, when, like you say, you have a whole unit coming off of quarantine, so now they're no longer going to be considered a positive and you can keep them in the same house together. But in your other instances, is there room to navigate positives out of negative situations into another housing without, Can it be managed? Is that why your folks are planning for those tents to come in still? Is that confusing?
No, it's not confusing. Some of the questions that you just asked was in your inquiry, I believe. And we did respond today. And so as far as housing, every day is a challenge, as Dr. Kemble said, and that's why we work with Dr. Kemble and her team, as well as Warden Sakara, on making sure that when an inmate is completed with quarantine, they are moved to an appropriate housing. So in our daily calls, we do go through step by step, inmate by inmate, who is cleared, who is not, who should be moved, and whatnot.
Okay.
So following up on that, Shari, Mark, if I can ask this question.
Yes, Judge, go ahead.
Okay, so also Ted inquired, so those inmates that have completed their sentence, and you know, basically there's no legal hold, what do you folks do? If you test them and if they're positive, what do you do? If negative, well, no problem.
For those scheduled releases, because they are released or they have a release date, we have to release them. And so we work with DOH as much as possible so that a letter of quarantine can go out with them or something like that. So if they have a scheduled release date, we do not hold them over because they're positive or whatever. We just work directly with DOH. And so it's always a going back and forth type relationship and conversation.
Okay, I understand. Do you folks have a list of release dates so that you might maybe a month or 2 weeks before the release date, you can test them so you can quarantine them or whatever? Mm-hmm. Or to address their status before release?
Yes, we actually started to provide weekly updates on our releases for the next 4 months through the end of the year. And we continually will send the Department of Health updated release, scheduled release lists so that we can work together.
Shari insisted. I just want to jump in on Judge Ibarra's question about the scheduled releases where you have no legal hold. How about those who post bail? How do you handle those? That's not a scheduled thing, but you have to release them.
Then we release them. And if they are pending a test or if they are positive, then we work with Department of Health and they actually reach out to the bail bondsman to get the address or the residence of which that person is bailing out to.
Okay.
I will say that that process is challenging though. And there are people being released every day who don't have definitive follow-up, and that's the reality.
Yeah.
But it's, but the, whether or not they're positive or negative is not a, does not hinder them from bailing out. Is that what I'm hearing, Sharon?
It cannot hinder them from bailing out.
Correct.
Yeah, Mark, if I could just, before I jump off, if I could just add to that question is that both the Department of Health and the Department of Public Safety are, must adhere to the court order. So if there is no way, if somebody bails out, then that means that there is no legal jurisdiction for the individual to be held regardless of their COVID status. We can try to work with them and identify the release address and see if we can work to get a director's order, but that's a whole nother process. The issue is that the as of right now, unless or until you know, the governor's office, for example, does a statewide stay-at-home order, for example. It's an individual basis, and it's inherently voluntary at the beginning. So we have to ask, first ask if they'd be willing to quarantine. We can't assume that people are going to break quarantine just because they're coming out of a correctional facility. So it's a quandary, and as I jump off, I just want to thank the commission for having me, and I am perfectly willing to come on again and continue this discussion, and Dr. Curtis and Dr. Campbell will be here to support as well.
Thank you, Eddie. That was was very informative.
Thanks, everybody.
Shari? Hello.
Go ahead. Mark? Go ahead, Judge Ibarra.
Shari?
Yes. Hello?
Okay, Shari, since the Supreme Court order was filed August 17 on regarding release of pretrial and other inmates, has there been an impact? And if so, how big on the release?
Any kind of release, Judge, at this point, whether it be 20, 40, 60, is a big impact for us at OCCC. Thank you.
But you will give us the number, as you said, later.
I was notified that there was 95 releases.
And this is pursuant to the Supreme Court order, or is this... Can you, like Martha said, can you break it down that those were already going to be released?
These were all Supreme Court orders.
Okay, so those folks are not the ones to that completed their sentences and was going to be released anyway.
Correct.
Or made bail.
I think I heard her very quietly say correct.
Yes, correct.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Now, there are subsequent court orders concerning the neighbor islands. And my biggest concern is the Punahele building at HCCC. That is so desperately overcrowded. And Shari, I know you're not a miracle worker, but do you have any idea of how the department's going to be addressing that most heavily overcrowded facility should there be an outbreak?
Martha, for that order, I believe the department met its deadline by sending out lists of inmates that would qualify.
Uh-huh.
We sent that list out. I believe the deadline was on the 22nd.
What?
Do you know how many were on that list?
No, I don't.
Yeah.
I was not the person that generated the list. Multiple people in public safety are all working with in different capacities.
Yeah, thank you.
Shari, along that line, if assuming you know enough about the plans at HCCC, what would you have to reduce the population to at HCCC to in order for the facility to be able to effectively manage any kind of outbreak? Do you folks have a number like that?
Ted, I'm going to have to get back to you on that. Sure. Because I got to look at the current population for today and see
where the facility stands.
So I'm going to have to get back to you.
Good if you can do that for Maui and Kauai too, because those two facilities have similar challenges.
Will do.
Yeah. Along that line, Shari, I know before this whole thing, in early March, I think starting in late February, actually, you folks had started working with other agencies to start reducing the population or reducing the flow into the facilities. That's my recollection. And so by mid to the end of March, we saw a significant decline in the population of the CCCs. Have you folks continued that work with the courts, the police, the prosecutors, other community agencies to manage the intake at the different facilities?
Ted, my understanding is that that all happened in the front end during that time under the other Supreme Court order. And the difference, and then the difference between now and then is that under the first court order, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the courts were closed.
Oh, okay.
And so there was not as many inmates coming in as we were releasing, because I think there was a stay-at-home court order in effect. Again, please correct me if I'm wrong. I'm just trying to think. There's so many things going on. But
this is a joke.
The difference between this Supreme Court order where the courts are not closed down.
Sure. So this is just a joke. I want to put it up front. So maybe one of the things we got to do is ask the courts to close. No, I don't expect a response. But sorry, the last meeting we asked about the intake rate at OCCC. Have you been able to get some firmer numbers as to how many inmates are coming into OCCC every day?
I'm sorry. Yes, we will get that number to you.
Okay. Okay, but they're still coming in.
Yes, they are.
I had this discussion on access to care for people outside and Medicaid, and I know this is more germane to the long-term population. Particularly sentenced inmates who may be on their way to parole. But the discussion was had to do with getting this population back on Medicaid. Can you tell us what you folks are doing for in that regard to make sure that people who leave the facility have medical coverage?
As Eddie from DOH said, we do have a process. And so I'm going to have to get back to you on exactly what that process is. But I do know that between the facility, our healthcare unit, and DHS, there is a process that where we do referrals. But I will have to get back to you.
Okay. In your response to the letter, I didn't read it very carefully because we just got it this afternoon. But you mentioned repurposing Module 20.
Ted, I'm going to have to ask that you, any specific facility, I guess, suggestions be held in abeyance right now, maybe for executive session?
Why is that, Lisa?
I think there are security issues about how certain or specific modules or specific units are going to be repurposed or reused or used in the first place. I think that's part of what Martha has wanted to amend the meeting agenda to allow for executive session later on for discussion. And I believe also that the PSD's previous submission was regarded as confidential. They did note that on the, I think on the letter.
Well, my question really has to do with the who was there, who has been housed in Module 20 and who will be housed in Module 20. For what purposes is repurposing happening?
Again,
so we can have an overall picture of what the situation is at OCCC.
I understand that, Ted, and I think that's why Martha wanted to have this discussion later on.
Well, so essentially, I can ask a question, but are you saying that Shari should not answer?
Yes, I don't think you should ask the question, because I think the PSC submission, if you look at it, says it's confidential and not a public document. And so I think we should just reserve that whole issue of question and answer to executive.
Yeah, I didn't see any confidential stamp on it, so I apologize. But okay, I'll hold the question. But so I had another question for Shari having to do with the housing units. And this one I hope is general enough to meet the test. How many living units are used right now for isolation purposes? How many for quarantine and how many for general population?
Ted, I don't know right now off the top of my head. I will have to get back to you folks.
Okay, and while
maybe
you do
I
that.
Can speak to that a little bit. I mean, really effectively, the only unit that's being treated as a true medical isolation unit is the one that's adjacent to the medical service area. So there's one unit that's being used for proper medical isolation. All other units may have cohorting in place from the discussions that we've had, but are not really proper medical isolation per se.
Okay, since you mentioned the term, I meant to ask you earlier, Doctor, when you say cohorting, can you describe what cohorting looks like at OCCC?
So cohorting means trying to separate positive and or sick individuals from those who are negative.
So
the ideal world scenario would be you'd have one cohort of positive and sick, another cohort of positive, not sick, another cohort of sick, but not yet proven to be positive, and then another cohort of negative and well. And there can either even be additional groups that you would set up in an ideal world. But I think here we're more sort of just along the lines of positive, negative, and what kind of, to what extent can any separation be?
So for example, we talked about the living unit where 70% were tested positive and the other 30% presumably were negative, but you said there's a probability that some of the 30% will test positive. So I presume the 30% is being cohorted. And what's
the cohort condition? That's a unit where cohorting did not seem feasible because we couldn't really move people safely for other reasons. And so that's a unit, and the areas that could physically be separated weren't balanced. The number of positives weren't balanced with the number of beds in those areas. So there's no way to have a pure positive cohort and then a pure negative cohort in that space. We made the decision that the more important thing to do was to separate modules from each other so that you aren't mixing modules with different levels of disease transmission with each other. Because trying to start moving people around when you have people that are incubating and converting to positive becomes a very tricky proposition. And you're more likely to cause more spread in trying to do that than in just keeping people in place. And then those units that are not heavily affected, you remove everyone who's positive as they become positive. And that's cohorting in the proper sense.
So you're talking about the specific challenges that OCCC is facing given the kind of facilities that they have.
Yes.
Very difficult.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
I have one question about that also, Dr. Kimball. And Dr. Kimball, I just want you to know that your mic keeps on going in and out, so we often miss everything you're saying.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It might be something with your computer as opposed to you.
Sorry.
When someone is sent to medical isolation, is it really they're being cohorted then with other people who've tested positive and are symptomatic, as opposed to actually going into a separate cell where they are isolated from everyone else?
So I would consider medical isolation, and that's this one module where people actually have their own individual cell. That's okay. True medical isolation, separate cells, and you're able to keep people separate so that they aren't coughing on each other. Cohorting is when you're combining positive people together in a shared space.
So do you believe the facility has been able to meet the medical isolation needs of actually putting everyone who requires it into a single cell?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Any more questions from the commissioners?
Ron, Mark, just a short observation. Department of Health is, I'm glad they're here, but if they add on conditions subsequent to the court order that are health-based, I'm not sure that is legal, because the default should be freedom for these folks that have tested, done what they need to do. That's just a gentle observation by me. So that part, I'm still trying to wrap my mind around what I heard from Eddie and the staff. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Okay, Ted, you good so far on this subject here? Martha?
Yeah.
Ron?
Yeah.
Good. I'm pretty sure, and maybe not, but right now my head is almost ready to burst from the amount of information that we have been being given by the Department of Health and continued information from Sherry. And it's so difficult to navigate this right now. Trying to get a hold of the entire situation. But there's no doubt that, as we've known already, three things that I heard today. One, the offenders are still coming into the system, okay? Police and the courts are not doing what they did 3 or 4 months ago when they literally were assisting PSD in managing the populations. So that's one. Two, there is great effort being done at this time to how to manage this closed environment right now at OCCC, where I'm assuming that, and more than likely that we're learning, yeah, about how to do that in terms of COVID-19 in preparation for other facilities as well. But we're doing the best we can. And bear with me as I go through my thought process. And then there's the releases, yeah? And how effective are the releases being done, or if even if they have any effect on what's going on in terms of managing the virus, yeah? And I say it in those three aspects, because the only thing that seems to be working at this time, or maybe from what I just heard today, is that we are heavily involved in trying to be successful at managing the population at this particular point, yeah? But as far as intakes and releases, we're still not where we want to be to help alleviate the managing of the population. So as a commission, that's kind of where we are at this particular point in time on where do we see ourselves imposing our abilities or our mandates to assist in this situation. Any comments from you, rest of the commissioners, on that?
Mark? Well, go ahead, Ron.
Okay, I have a comment. I heard that the courts were closed, but the courts were not closed. I think the courts were open in a sense that they were not doing jury trials. It was continued. They're doing some criminal matters, and referrals to the community centers or jail were cut, as you said, because basically, number one, the prosecutors, even though they were making cases, they were not asking for arrest warrants, which required bail. And if the defendants could not post bail, they go to ACCC or whatever community facility. So that's one. Number two, the prosecutors were not asking, again, for warrants, but they were asking for penal summons or information, meaning that, and this along with the police, that people were arrested, but instead of charged, were released and told, given a court date to come to court. So they were not going to the correction facilities. So basically, the police had a lot to do, the prosecutor had a lot to do, there were less arrest warrants were made, and we required bail. And most of them were using penal summons. The grand juries were not convened, I think, and so that did not involve more grand jury indictments. But even if they were convened, I believe the grand juries did not issue as much arrest warrant, but summons, again, to give notice to the defendant to come to court. When you get a summons, basically there's no bail, there's no incarceration. The defendant is given a notice, and if he does not or she does not appear in court, then a warrant of arrest or contempt would issue. Again, in the whole system, so even if we were to set a population-based number for corrections, if the police, the prosecutor, the courts continued with bail and the people could not make bail, basically, it's going to go to corrections. And unless corrections exercise their own authority under the statute to release people, we're going to end up with the same situation, if not more. Supreme Court could come in again. And so, if we're looking at the overall system, we've got to address all the players in the criminal justice system, from the police, prosecutor, courts, public safety, and including the service providers outside, housing and things like that. Because if you think about it, we can set the population level, but if the courts keep putting them in, I feel for the public safety. What are they going to do?
Yeah, so, Ron, just to put an exclamation point, and we keep saying ACCC, but other facilities have challenges too. But at ACCC, the population went down to 234 on April 30. And as of August 17th, it was up to 355. Mm-hmm. Basically, I want to say that this is very informative. And I want to thank both the PSD and the Department of Health staff, Eddie and his gang, for providing all of this information and being so open. But I come up with three conclusions. Number one is, you know, we had been told, and I believe the commission knew from the beginning, that this could pose a significant public health issue. It's not an issue that's going to be simply within the correctional facilities. If there's infections in a correctional facilities, it will impact the community. That's number one. So I think those thoughts are being confirmed. And second is, like Judge Ibarra just said, there's a real need for a multi-agency approach to this. Public safety can't do it alone. And the third for me is, we really need to, as a community, we need to get ahead of this. So we've got to work aggressively to stop any outbreaks within the Neighbor Island facilities, because it would spread as fast, if not faster, than it did at OCCC. Mm-hmm. So those are the three takeaways I get from today's meeting.
Mark?
Yes, Mike, go ahead.
At some point too, I'd like to hear from Eric Seitz and Bob Mercer and anybody else, because I'm not convinced that we're not getting what I would call iatrogenic effects. People getting sicker because they're in jail versus out of jail and bailed out. And the more we put them in, and the sicker they get. And I'm not, nor am I convinced. I don't know how many people actually, how many ACOs and how many of our inmates had to be hospitalized or on ventilators. Those are really important facts. I know some may be confidential, but that's worrying me. I'm not buying for a second that public safety has all the numbers, because they've got a huge job. So that's just my take.
Right now, I'm just trying to focus on what our authority is as a commission, yeah? And taking in the information that we have here, and how do we become an effective force of change to actually help public safety and to help the situation at hand. I can understand all the issues that are going on within the facility at that time, the individual issues, the individual with the virus at this particular point in time. But what is it that we can truly do to be an effective force in causing change to occur within that facility at this time? When we talk about intake releases and the current situation, we want to be able to take the document that we hope to discuss today, which is setting the capacity, which is our mandate by law, is to set the capacity of the facilities, is to set that document, come back with it, and tell the participants in the system, this is where, what is your role on helping us to set these capacities. That is a clear line of authority that we are given by the state. And we need to have something of that nature in order to be a force of change for the current situation. That's where I'm coming from, and that's where I'm hoping we're trying to lead all this discussion and to figure this out, you know. If we don't have any more discussion on this right now, I'd like to ask Sherry one more question before we move on to the public testimony. Anything else, commissioners?
I had a question, but it's I'm wondering, Mark, if you have an update on the status of our coordinator and the funding. Have you had any discussions with the Attorney General's office about this? Or maybe Lisa, if you're still there, do you know?
I have nothing further to add. Unfortunately, I haven't heard anything more since.
Okay.
Oh, right. Mark, I have a question for Shari.
Okay,
Shari, thank you for being here. My understanding is public safety, because certainly we can set the population capacity, whether it's interim, emergency, but the bottom line is the capacity has to be, addressed or has to be complied with. So my question is, absent any court orders, any Supreme Court orders, if public safety got a capacity number, will public safety use their authority under the statute to try to meet that capacity? And first, do you agree or or believe that the director, Department of Public Safety, has the authority to release?
Judge, I think it would be best answered if you guys just submit those along with the other questions in writing so that we can just research and make sure that our response is what it needs to be.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, thanks, yeah, Judge.
I do want to make one comment about that. Lisa, you brought up that we've been asked to keep things confidential that come from the Department of Public Safety. When we put out a question like this in a public meeting and we are responded in writing, that answer should be public.
Not necessarily. I mean, certainly you can ask the question, but I mean, if you can ask a question about their medical history or whatever, and the person may come back with a response, but that necessarily doesn't mean that the response is public. I think if you're talking about the submissions that Public Safety had today, I think they have indicated that that's confidential. There are certainly, I mean, there might be a public version that could be released later on, but I think the specific questions that you wanted to ask and wanted to get answers to, as you noted earlier, had some security issues, connected to them, and some other issues connected to them. So it's not necessarily just asking a question in a public forum.
Okay, Lisa, I guess in the previous report, if you look at the 2001 report, we reported living units, capacities, and the type of population would be in those living units. You know, we don't want to violate anything that would impact public safety security operations or the security of facilities, but there's other information that should be public. I mean, I'm of the opinion that just because public safety slaps confidential on a piece of paper, that may be challenged whether it's actually confidential or not.
I understand that, but I haven't had a chance to look at what Public Safety submitted, so I can't. All I can say is that, you know, they asked that it be kept confidential at this time. Now, again, there might be a public version that could be released of that. You know, certain portions may have to be redacted and so forth. But right now, not having looked at that document, I can't say that. That's all I wanted to point. Certainly, there can be parts of it that could be released.
And I want to make it clear, Shari wasn't saying that her response would be confidential. She's saying that it's so many questions have been asked. She's asking for it in writing because there's a lot of things to answer. But I'm just concerned about your position on it, Lisa, that kind of everything they say is confidential is automatically confidential.
No, that's not it. It just has to be reviewed. I can't say as to what Public Safety said today. I just haven't seen that yet.
Okay, thank you.
Chair, there's been a lot of questions and very few answers. And if you can put it on the next response to us, be fine. But Arizona has keep on coming up because we hear so little about them. I know you reported last time that there were no COVID-19 reports. But we would appreciate if you can expand on the whatever reporting you are getting from the specific facilities that house our men in Arizona on what's going on within their facilities and how the safety issues are being taken care of. Is that a possibility?
So just to clarify your question, you wanted to know if there was any positive COVID cases in Saguaro as of today? Sorry.
Well, that's one question. Or just the overall status of the facility that's managing our population, and if they're having any COVID issues, and are they keeping our offenders safe at this time?
So I can report that as of today, there is no COVID positive cases amongst the Hawaii population. As far as the overall safety concern of the population at Saguaro, we can get back to you in writing.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Shari. At this time, I want to open up to some of the public testimonies on what we the discussion that we just had. So I'll just look at a waved hand and I'll call you. For those of you that are on video, let me see.
Mark, I see Eric's hand.
Eric, okay, go ahead, Eric.
Last time that I spoke to you, I told you that I was in the process of preparing a lawsuit in behalf not only of inmates, but also of staff members who are desperately concerned, among other things, because the lack of information as to what's going to happen to them, and their families are equally concerned. We did not file that lawsuit because on Friday, I was assured by the Attorney General's office in writing and in conversations that they're moving forward to provide more resources to the prison, that they recognize the primary areas of concern, people moving back and forth in an uncontrolled way, people coming and going without being monitored on the outside, that they are getting more testing, more repeat testing, so that it's not a question of relying upon old or inaccurate data. And I was comfortable enough with the submissions that were made to me and the fact that those resources are on the way, and particularly the representations that were made to me about the role that the Department of Health was going to be playing, that I did not file the lawsuit. And I haven't filed it today because I've gotten additional reassurances that more resources are in place that I think hopefully will attempt to alleviate the situation, although we don't know how that's going to play out. My overall reactions to what we heard from Eddie's team and the doctors reinforces what I know from my own personal experience working with them over the weekend with a client who was released and who became positive, who's out in the community, and they're helping to take care of him. They've helped him get health insurance. They've put him up in a hotel. They've transported him to a hospital when he developed symptoms over the weekend. So those kinds of things are in place, which are an enormous improvement from what we saw just a few days ago. I will say, though, I've heard very little about the monitoring and help that's going to staff, the 40-some cases. We've heard rumors about staff members having to be hospitalized and having much more serious symptoms. That hasn't really been spoken to, and we don't know about that. But I will say that I am more than happy to work with the Department of Health regarding these matters. I have had less confidence in the Department of Public Safety. My understanding, and maybe that's going to be reported to you in some other form, is that the Department of Public Safety is reorganizing in some way so that new people are being brought in to provide resources to coordinate and provide responses to some of the issues. But I am concerned that as we sit here today, you're still being told, put it in writing, we'll give you answers. The answers are going to be confidential. And that's not what the public and the people, the inmates and the staff and their families needs to hear. One of the things that was most promising to me was the fact there were going to be federal funds brought in. They would be able to create tent cities and put people in hotels and to expand that to provide the kind of separation which will enable people to effectively fight the circumstances that we now find ourselves in. I would like to see a good deal more detail about that and when it's going to happen. I'm not going to go out and file a lawsuit because I don't want to drag people into court and then have resources directed toward litigation that ought to be directed toward the underlying problems. But we need a lot more information a lot faster. We need much more multi-agency attention to this. I think the Department of Health is doing great work. We need the Department of Human Services to be involved in a greater way. And I would like to know, Sarah has just indicated in the chat room that she's got information about what's happening with the staff. And I certainly think that should be shared as soon as possible. But again, I thank you for the opportunity to address you, and I'm ready to help in any way I can.
Thank you, Eric. Appreciate that.
Thank you. Sorry, I just got an update from my team, and I apologize not having verified this before speaking earlier, but we do have reports of 3 staff from OCCC hospitalized as of today, 2 in ICU.
Thank you, Sarah. Anybody else?
Mark, I see Bob Merz's hand.
Okay.
I know it's been a long day, but maybe I could just ask Dr. Kimball. We have 240 inmates, none of whom have been hospitalized, but we have only 40 staff, and we have 3 hospitalizations with 2 in the ICU. How can that be? It seemed like the ratio would have to be somewhat the same, but it doesn't appear to be anywhere close. Only 1 inmate out of 240 some hospitalized, but so many ACOs or staff, and they're in ICU. And I take it if they're in ICU, they very well may be on ventilators and very seriously ill. It makes me suspicious as to whether or not the inmates are getting hospitalized at the same rate that they ought to be.
It's a difficult question to answer, in part because the relative number of hospitalizations overall is still small. So statistically speaking, we can see enough errors that it's hard to compare those 2 numbers right now. I have to admit myself being surprised at not seeing more hospitalizations among the inmates so far. And I have some medical theories about that, which of course is just my conjecture. But one is that the inmates are in much more crowded living conditions than the officers overall. And so the capacity for rapid spread, even of low levels of viral inoculation, are quite great. And so you may have more asymptomatic infection in these settings. And this has been shown in some of the correctional setting outbreaks on the mainland as well, where they're reporting very high rates of asymptomatic infection. I do think that there are probably also is underreporting of symptoms among inmates. Although I haven't dealt with COVID in a correctional setting before, when I was working previously in Chicago, I dealt with a large salmonella outbreak in the Cook County jail system. And we found that inmates were they had reasons, motivations to not share their symptoms sometimes because it might result in medical isolation, which they may not want. There's other factors at play. So I think we have to sort of take symptom reporting with a grain of salt. That being said, I think it would be fairly apparent if people were sick enough to require hospitalization. So I'm not sure that we're missing people who should be hospitalized. I am told that the medical staff are managing to maintain twice daily symptom checks for all inmates. So as long as that's being maintained, I would imagine we'd have pretty good visibility on people requiring hospitalization.
I hope so. Do you know how many, can anybody answer the question, how many physicians are there full-time taking care of the 240 people? And are they housed in the medical unit or are they just housed together or how is that working? Do we have enough doctors and nurses is my concern. And maybe we don't have time to go through an answer of all these questions, but that's certainly
Bob, can I interject? We want to just, you can provide testimony and make some statements, but this wasn't meant to be a questioning and answer thing.
Okay. Okay. One of my concerns is the number of medical personnel that are taking care of these 240 people. I'm also concerned that the CDC guidelines provide that if you do quarantine certain cohorts that are positive, certain things should be provided, such as telephone privileges for free, and a lot of other privileges. And I'm concerned that those recommendations of the CDC are probably not being followed, we don't know the number of people who are coming in. I would think that would be on the tip of everybody's tongue and everybody would know that. We don't know how far away from the design capacity we are, which is something we ought to know. We don't know, I don't hear anybody talking. We do know that the chief of police has taken a really hard line on And I was just looking at some of their arrest records, and they're still arresting people for violations. And I'm wondering if anybody from the Department of Public Safety, the Department of Health, is trying to talk to the chief of police and get her to start acting in a more reasonable fashion and use methods other than incarceration to deal with some of these situations in the community. So those are my comments.
Thank you, Bob. Appreciate that. And those are all good questions, Bob. All good questions. Anybody else? If I can't see you, you can just say you want to speak.
This is Carolyn, and my question has to do with the weekly lists. The public safety people say they hand over either to the Department of Health or to somebody to let them know about inmates scheduled for release. And I wonder if the dates of those releases are given out 2 to 3 weeks in advance so that there's time to arrange for help with Medicaid. And if they're only given with a week's notice before the release happens, it would seem that that may not be time enough to do everything, to set things in place.
What we're actually receiving, the Department of Health right now has already received from OCCC the complete list of anticipated releases through December. So what we're asking on a weekly basis is updates to that list. So it may miss people who maybe are suddenly scheduled for release within the next week, but I think for the most part, we'd be capturing people pretty well in advance.
That's reassuring. I hope so.
Thank you, Carolyn. Anyone else?
Mark, this is Ted. I have one more question, and this is actually for public safety. How about La Maca? It's across the street and completely separated from the main facility. Are we testing there?
Yes, testing was completed in La Maca
okay.
as well.
Oh, thank you. Okay.
Mark, Carrie Ann asked to speak. Carrie Ann Shirota.
Go ahead, Carrie Ann.
Aloha. I guess I have some comments and some questions. The first is, you know, to be proactive, since we know that there is community surge on every single island, and this cannot just be contained at OCCC, what is the policy going to be moving forward to do universal or some kind of sampling testing at every single jail and prison, including Saguaro, with our inmate population? The second thing is, you know, we keep hearing reference to sort of, it almost seems like fly by the seat of our pants kind of planning. The Department of Public Safety has mentioned for months that they have this gold standard pandemic plan. And I'd like to know, or for the department to explain at some point to the public, who created this plan? Who did they consult? Was it in compliance with CDC guidelines? Have they updated it to reflect more recent guidelines? Not just for to look back, but how do we move forward from here to further prevent mitigation efforts at all of the facilities? So who has been a part of that? How was it created? For the current doctors, and I appreciate Dr. Kimball and Curtis joining us, thank you for what you're doing. But I guess my question too, for two physicians, if there will be a further outbreak at all of these other jails and prisons here and in Arizona, how are you gonna be able to assist and provide guidance at all of these different jails on the neighbor islands and at Saguaro? I mean, in terms of just resource capacity, and has there been any consultation with other medical experts in other states, from the East Coast to outbreaks in New York, Rikers, to San Quentin, because they've been a few months ahead of us in terms of the outbreak, and what lessons have they learned specific to correctional facilities that can help us to prevent further spread into our facilities here in Hawaii. The third, I think, relates to just what I feel like is a conflict of interest. And it's, you know, it's the way that the statute is written, but the Oversight Commission is being guided and receiving advice from the Attorney General's office. And at the same time, the Attorney General's office provides advice and essential advice and defends the Department of Public Safety. And so it seems to me that there is an inherent conflict of interest. You know, it's essentially serving two masters, and who is the Attorney General advising? And this is not anything personal against Lisa Otemoro, but I feel like in terms of the enabling statute, it is a real concern as to who is being represented by the advice here. The other question for the Department of Public Safety, this goes back to, are they utilizing every tool within their disposal to help people who can be released safely into the community from work furlough, extended work furlough, electronic monitoring furlough, medical compassionate release? For those individuals that may qualify, are they being moved out into the community to allow for space and so less severe overcrowding? I've heard today, and I don't know if it's true, but there's word that there are two positive cases at Maui Jail. And if that is so, again, how is word being communicated back? Is it essentially that Oahu is giving information? Will there be consultation and work between the Department of Health offices on Maui, Hawaii Island, Kauai support? At Saguaro, I am concerned because even though there's, quote, been reported no cases, that's what we also were told for months, that there was no reported cases in our jails and prisons. And specifically at Saguaro, has the department answered why Nevada inmates were being returned home, and then I believe Idaho or some other state was being brought in? If that is the case, are they testing every single individual who's coming in from another state? And are they truly being separated? Because I heard word from at least one attorney that there was a mixing within a cell between Hawaii and another state. So if that is the case, that is not only a contract violation, but how can you assure the community that people are safe when there is this mixing? And I think lastly, all of you have alluded to this, commissioners, and I think it's a really important point, is that all the different agencies need to work collaboratively here. And so at some point, I think it would be beneficial to invite HPD chief of police, invite the prosecutors, invite the AG's office, judiciary, probation, and parole, because the only way that we can reduce the population across the board is with all of these agencies taking some responsibility and contributing to the solution. Because some people who are in on probation violation could be safely placed in the community. Some people who might be in parole in other facilities, revocation, could be placed safely into the community. And until we do that, we're gonna just see just marginal dips, and then it's gonna be back to the same, up again, down below. We need everybody to be working together to decarcerate. And thank you for the opportunity to share these comments.
Thank you, Marianne.
I'm about to go on, but I'll come find you in a second.
Mark, Jackie asked if she can speak also.
Oh.
Okay, Jackie, you on.
Hi.
You're on.
Was I not on mute?
We enjoyed your conversation.
Thank you for sharing.
I apologize for that. I must have hit unmute too early. But one concern that I have, stressing Bob's point about the number. So there's 240 something people incarcerated who have tested positive, only one hospital, and we know 43 ACOs, and there's five currently ACOs who are currently hospitalized. So I'm wondering if the Oversight Commission has any authority to direct DPS to suspend the $3 charge for medical services, because I am thinking that even though the test for COVID is free, that many people will not seek medical attention due to the requirement of paying $3. So is that something? And then I also agree with Carrie Ann, if we could get Chief Ballard to come and hear her response on, you know, we have to stop the front door as well. And we need her to work together to do that, because that's largely her authority. DPS is dealing with people once they're in there, but we need her on board to stop putting people in there that don't need to be in there. So is that something that the Oversight Commission could help with?
Mark?
Yes, Ted.
Didn't we get some communication from PSD recently saying that they did suspend the $3 copay?
Copay was suspended for inmates who present respiratory symptoms. Okay. What Jackie is answering, I would say the answer is no. Okay. They haven't suspended full, but anything COVID related had been suspended.
Shari, if you're still on, can you confirm?
As of April 17th, they suspended the copay for any inmate exhibiting respiratory symptoms. And I believe our documentation was also addressed in our response.
Okay. And Shari, since you're on, you heard Carrie Ann talk about two possible cases on Maui. Can you confirm for that? Because, you know, it's better if the information comes out rather than spread by rumor, so people can get on top of it quickly.
As of right now, we do not have any positive COVID cases at Maui.
Yeah, but I would advise that you double check on that just to make sure.
We did. It is confirmed.
Okay.
Thank you, Sherry. Can I get any more comments?
I just wanted to say, this is Kat. In Halava. Aloha, everybody. Thank you so much for your work. In Halava, people who maybe didn't expressly show signs of COVID, but were exposed to COVID-exposed people or COVID-positive people, have been denied tests. That seems ridiculous. When they know that they, you know, were near somebody who tested positive, they should be able to get a test.
Okay. We're going to have that discussion with PSD, Kat. Thank you so much. Not hearing any more comments at this time. Okay. Martha, I don't know if we need a motion, but I want to thank the Department of Health and Public Safety for being here for this meeting today. There are a lot of information, everybody, and we got to kind of sort this out. But my last summary that I talked about in terms of the capacity and how we come out and make a statement and begin to push for those concerns is where we're heading to at this particular point in time. We are operating, as you know, in the same conditions that we have been operating since we were formed. So be patient with us. We're going to double check on the confidentiality of some of those reports that was given to us. And it was actually pieces of those reports that was confidential. And let's see if we can get some of those pieces that were not confidential out to you folks, so we can answer some of the questions that Carrie Ann had put forth. And that's where we are right now. So for the public, I want to just appreciate you folks for being here today and bearing with the 2 hours of information that we have. And let's continue to push forward and trying to get things done at this time. The commission will be meeting in executive session at this time. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Can there be a vote to move into the executive session?
Thank you. Mahalo.
Martha, you want to move?
All right. I move that we dismiss the meeting and reconvene in executive session.
Glutton for punishment.
seconded by Ted. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Okay. We're just waiting for everybody to